Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. Learn how to go from product manager to product master using the roadmap at theeverydayinnovator.com. I read Crossing the Chasm when it was published in 1991. The third edition was released last year with updated examples of how companies successfully increased the market for their new products. The book introduced me to the market development model, which had a significant impact on how I thought about the relationship between product growth and market segments. To explore this model, I asked Michael Eckhart to tell us about it and what it means to cross the chasm. He is the managing director and senior workshop leader at Chasm Institute, a consultancy to tech companies. He's a veteran of Price Waterhouse, Harbridge Consulting, HP, and PepsiCo, an MBA graduate of Harvard Business School, and Wall Street Journal Award winner. Michael's an expert recognized in new venture success and go-to-market best tools and practices. He has worked with over 90 tech companies, spanning 500 and growing client engagements over the last 15 years. In the interview, you will learn the importance of recognizing the condition of the category a product is launched into, as well as what is required to move from one stage of the appropriate market for the category to the next appropriate stage. It is really helpful to have a picture of the market development model to place in context the concepts Michael addresses. Find this picture along with other resources and the transcript of the interview at theeverydayinnovator.com/079. Enjoy the interview. Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for being part of the Everyday Innovator podcast.
Great. Thanks, Chad. Good to be here.
I'm glad you're here to talk about kind of a go-to-market strategy in terms of life cycle. We'll talk more in terms of what specifically that life cycle is in just a moment. But let's set the stage first, because there might be a little bit of confusion. I've ran into this as I've talked to other people, and I've had the same confusion before. You're the managing director at the Chasm Institute, and Jeffrey Moore is the author of the book, Crossing the Chasm. And he says that you and the co-manager there have helped more companies successfully cross the chasm than anyone else. So just to help listeners understand, what is the relationship between Jeffrey Moore's book and the Chasm Institute?
Sure. So both the book and Chasm Institute have been around for quite a while, for more than 15 years. Chasm Institute, Jeffrey Moore is the chairman of the of our firm, and I'm one of the two managing directors. We've got about 15 people broadly defined across the world in different locations working with us. And even though I'm a managing director, I don't do that much managing. I love working with clients, and that's really what I've done the last 15 plus years. Jeff is the main author. I've been involved in the writing and the editing of really the last four or five books. And it's always a pleasure to be able to talk about the concepts and, more importantly, make them real for people as opposed to just the theory of the target market model or customer adoption, but make it pliable and real for innovators and product managers.
And it is because of that hands-on experience that I'm so excited to have a chance to talk with you. Because I know you've worked now with nearly 100 different companies and helping them with this issue of what we'll talk about, what it means across the chasm. And when you say the book's been around 15 years, at the latest third edition is what, 2 years old?
About a year old now, okay. Yeah. So when many of your listeners on the audience participation here, back in 1991 was the first version of the book. It was really the first book that took the idea about taking both tech products, but also any disruptive or new products to market, mm-hmm. not just toothpaste and running shoes and refrigerators, but truly things that are kind of changing the world and how to get those into mainstream markets. That was really the first book to really do that back in the early 90s. We thought we were going to sell maybe 5,000 of those through our publisher. And happily, we just crossed the milestone, actually, of 2 million books being purchased by worldwide readers in the last 15-plus years.
That's congratulations. Not a lot of books. That's great.
Yeah, that's not a lot of books, Chad, by the way, when you compare it to the Harry Potter series. during its high point, they probably sold that many on a Tuesday afternoon. But the 2 million for us is very specific around people who are product managers, product management directors and VPs, and innovation people. And so for them, we've tried to speak to them and improve the book. So last thing to mention about it, because this is not about the book, this is about the concepts and the practical application, is about 2 years ago, the dean of the engineering school at Stanford came to us and said, could you please come out with a third version of the Crossing the Chasm book? And we said, well, you know, that's a lot of work. Really? You want us to? And he said, yeah. And the reason is all the examples you have in there are great, but we'd like you to put company examples in there for people under the age of 30 would recognize those company examples. So we laughingly acknowledged that that was a need. So the book came out a year ago with all 25 new company examples, whether it's Google or Apple or VMware or 3D printing, a lot of things in both tech and a few non-tech examples. So there we are.
Very good. And I do want the listeners to know, I was one of those readers in 1991 when it first came out. At the time, I was a product manager doing software projects and found it really eye-opening for me. It really helped me think differently about what it meant to get a product launched and then what to expect, not just having buyers magically show up, but what to expect and what one had to do to get that thing really adopted in the marketplace and be successful. So I do encourage Everyday Innovators, everyone listening, to check it out, and I'll make sure the links are in the show notes for that too.
Great.
Now, Michael, I have a rather ambitious agenda for our discussion because I really want to go through your take on what I'll call the traditional target market adoption lifecycle that you call, in one place at least, the market development model, which is that kind of early market, and then the tornado, the bowling aisle, Main Street, and total simulation. We'll talk through those terms in a moment. And talk in terms of how, if we were going to do a MVP, minimal viable product approach, how that would progress through those phases and what to kind of expect at that. But this kind of reminds me, I think we might need to set the stage. I'd like to get your perspective on how a traditional, what people might be thinking of as a traditional product lifecycle, where we, you know, introduce a product, we see it grow, we see it hit maturity, then we see it decline and finally retire from the marketplace, how that relates to the work that you've done with the Chasm.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great stage setting for it as well, Chad. So good point. Yeah. So a couple things to bring up, the common misconceptions and also maybe a bit of clarification to start with. One is, you know, product managers, product executives, innovators, you know, pretty tough job. You're influencing people, sometimes not truly controlling them. Mm-hmm. And the reality is this, is that you have a product lifecycle process probably in place in most of your companies. That's a PLC. We at Chasm Institute believe that's a very important tool and work process. But what we're going to talk about here is actually not the product lifecycle. It's something where the product lifecycle lives within. And we call that the target market model. And the product lifecycle, as many of you on the interview here know, as an audience member, is really about how you develop a product, when you, as a company, decide to launch that product, how you manage it, and eventually how you obsolete it. Hmm. When the next iPhone comes out, or the next headset, or the next flavor of barbecued pizza with turkey topping and so forth on it. Whatever it is, food and beverage, banking, construction, or tech, you control those as the product manager with the influence of executives and R&D and engineering about when you launch, how you manage, and when you obsolete. What Chad is bringing up in this interview, which is important, we believe, as a distinction, is the target market model is not about you and when you decide to launch. It's about where your product is in terms of category and how mature it is on this whole thing we call the target market model. And the target market model is made up, and many of you may be familiar with some of the early parts of it. Chad just mentioned the stages. There's early market, there's Chasm, there's bowling alley, there's tornado, and there's Main Street. And those all sound like, you know, buzzwords, once again, from a consultant who's eager to sell books and throw new concepts out there. But the reality is these are basically stages of how customers' buying behaviors change depending on how mature or how nascent your product category is. And so if you keep in mind the numbers, think of early market as stage one, Chasm stage two, bowling alley stage three, tornado stage four, and Main Street stage five. And by the way, not every category gets to each one of these stages. You can have something like artificial intelligence that's been talked about and debated about for 25 years that was sitting in stage one early market for about 24 of those 25 years and is now slowly making it across in, for example, voice recognition technology. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. So stage one on the early market, this is not when your product is new to be launched. This is when the category is new. So it might be 3D printing. It might be sushi in the American palate back in the 1960s, when you still do explain to people that normal people actually do eat raw fish. Or it might be something along the lines of a new ingredient or a new solution set for medicine, disease, FDA types of solutions. So across the full spectrum. So early market for product managers is something you're quite familiar with. And one of our colleagues, you know, Steve Blank on the lean side and the lean startup side, has done a really good job of characterizing what MVP needs to be for the early market. We would say for 1A and 1B, and you're thinking, oh boy, we're slicing and dicing the early market up, that's where MVP really plays a role. That is, can you get 80% of the total customer requirements down to at least get this into the hands of early adopters, have them use it, provide feedback, and so forth. That stage is 1A and 1B, early to mid mainstream. Things change in 1C, which is late Main Street or in Chasm Crossing. And what happens there is you go from MVP, minimum viable product, to something else, because you're now looking at the pragmatic audience to get across this crevasse or this ravine or what we call the chasm. Mm-hmm. And there it's actually minimum viable whole product. And that's not 80%. That's 100%. Not 100% of a perfect product, but 100% of what the pragmatist customer in the near term needs to get what we call the compelling reason to buy fulfilled. So the MVP lean concept is extremely powerful for early 1A and 1B, but when you go across the chasm into the normal marketplace, they don't want to be guinea pigs, test cases, or alpha or beta victims. They want a whole product. That means support, that means training, that means documentation in some cases, and it means a working product.
And Michael, sorry, let me just ask you about some of the terminology here. The 1A, the 1B, as you talk through this, are these just different terms for those stages?
Yeah, great question. So what I'm doing is taking early market, 1A and 1B and 1C, dividing into three stages of early market. So you'll see an A, B, and C for Tornado and A, B, and C for Main Street. And while this may sound a little too detailed, what it really means is the early market is a big place. And if you're in the first third of it or the second third of it, that's 1A and 1B, there you can get away with an 80% whole product.
Okay.
But as you segue to what we're going to call stage two, which is chasm crossing, or stage three, early bowling alley, which is segment or application centric or target customer centric, there we need to put together what we call a minimum viable whole product. And that's not what you want to deliver. That's not what your executive thinks is the whole product. It's actually what the customer expects as a minimum viable total solution for their needs.
And do you have an image of this for listeners to know that might be in the show notes later that I can include?
Sure. Think of it as a the classic donut wheel or bagel wheel that says you've got core product at the center. Mm-hmm. Then you have typically 15 to 20 things around the outside. We call those enablers. We used to call those years ago components, but people thought they were just hardware. But that's not what we're talking about here. It could be consultation. It could be pre-sales. It could be training. It could be application software. It could be if you're into foods, it might be the packaging of that food and how you show the ingredients and so forth. So it's the full, shall we call it, enchilada for what's required for a customer to buy.
Okay. And so just listeners, make sure you hit the show notes too for this episode to see the image for this model, as well as we'll put some more detail in there for the whole product too.
Right.
Okay. So we're at the early market stage with our MVP. You said that for that to be successful, we need to capture about 80% of the requirements of what that early adopter is willing to, the requirements that satisfy the problem that they have and provide them value. And I think we are moving into the MVP for the whole product. Is that we're crossing that chasm between that early market and into the bowling aisle?
Right. And the whole product, think of it as an insurance policy that allows a pragmatist to both buy it, use it, and recommend it to others. It may not be everybody. Mm-hmm. If you think of like companies that we work with here in Silicon Valley or some of you located in key cities around the world, it may be, for example, Nest is, as some of you might know, the thermostat and web-based, cloud-based solution set that Google bought a couple years back. They had to come out with whole product going into the main marketplace. One small thing, which was not so small, is in every Nest package for thermostats, there's three different kinds of screws and three different kinds of deployment choices for how you actually construct and then add that to the wall, depending on your house, what your original thermostat looked like, and so forth. So it's the minimum viable, not the kitchen sink.
Mm-hmm. Another example I've always liked is, we kind of forget when the iPod was first released by Apple, it wasn't really as successful as we tend to think of it now. And that was because iTunes did not exist.
Right.
And it was later, I think about 6 months later, so I might be wrong, when iTunes showed up, that now made it really easy to get music onto the iPod.
Right.
That now we're getting that more whole product concept, right?
Yeah, that's a great example, Chad. And you might say, well, that's a nice plus one or different. No, it's not. It's exactly as you stated, which is, we'll use the word ecosystem, which says it's the full range of what's needed to get the job done. And for music, it was the downloadability, shall we say, from iTunes that made this a whole product. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was huge. We had 100 MP3 players on the market at the time. They all had the same problem. How do you get music onto them? And the iPod came along as a very nice design device, but we still had the same problem until we got iTunes.
You bet. And that's even true in things like construction services or in banking or in other areas like food and beverage or CPG beyond tech. Its whole product is really what the customer experience is expected to be by the pragmatists in what we'll call the bowling alley. And the reason we call it the bowling alley is it's about the physics of hitting the head pin, the head segment, and then getting adjacent pins to fall. Always sounds easy on a podcast, obviously hard in real life, but we've now done this work with about 500 different companies. I've been involved in about 150 of those over the last 15 years to really help them identify and prioritize and actually deliver whole product, minimum viable whole product to the right segment. That's bowling alley.
And let's dwell there just for a moment. Do you have an example you could share with us of hitting that first pin? And I know other terms out there like this is the beachhead concept, right? Where do you go first? What is that first company you can get that then will help you knock down some other sales too with other companies?
Sure. Lots of examples. We've easily got 100 of those, but I'll pick one, which is on the medical device side, kind of intriguing, which is the external automated defibrillators for cardiac arrest. I won't mention the company name, but the one we worked with originally back when these were still $3,000 per pop, their vision was we want an AED or automated external defibrillator, you know, kind of like a fire extinguisher in everybody's home, in everybody's office, in everybody's locale, at everybody's swim club and sports club. That'll be pretty cool. That'll be 500 million of those things. And nothing wrong with that, but that's the long-term vision. The near-term vision is what segment to go after first. And we actually helped this company identify 11 different possible segments. One of those, which turned out not to be a good one, which is rich guys on yachts over the age of 60 with heart problems. You might think that's a good segment. We're saying that half jokingly, but that's not a good segment. Didn't score well based on our criteria. The first real segment was basically the top three airlines in the U.S., Delta, American, United, who realized that their obligation for taking a customer who's having cardiac arrest and landing at the nearest airport, dumping tens of thousands of gallons of fuel, inconveniencing 250 passengers on the plane, but instead helping that customer, the cardiac patient on the plane with a defibrillator, would actually save lives and also not be too bad for their business model either, quite frankly.
Absolutely.
That turned out to be the head pin where it actually became then regulated by the FAA that any U.S. airline with more than 100 passengers had to have a trained person on board, typically a flight attendant, to administer this. That then went to airports. You see them there every 300 meters at the airport, to private corporate jets, to health clubs, etc. So it's moved into the bowling alley, into a variety of different places, even as prices come down.
Great example, finding that first segment that then leads you to other opportunities.
Yeah. By the way, that's the antithesis of the strategy we don't recommend in Chasm Crossing, which is something, of course, no one we know or you know would ever do, which we call it the spray and pray strategy.
The shotgun approach.
The shotgun approach, which is throw it out there and then pray that 20% of the market somehow endorses it, which is a pipe dream on Chasm Crossing. But to continue on the conversation with whole product, once you've identified and optimized whole product for segments, there's a good chance that at Bowling Alley now is stage three, that stage four, of course, further right in the past the chasm, is what we call tornado stage. That's hypergrowth stage. That's where you saw smartphones over a 3 to 4 year period. One of the chapters in our books focuses on that. And that goes from minimum viable product, no, to minimum viable whole product, no, to the next stage in tornado, which what we'll describe in tornado is what we're looking for as a friction-free product. And by friction-free, we mean a product that's easy to buy, easy to sell, easy to understand, easy to install, or easy to eat, or easy to develop, whatever it is your customer has to do with it. And so the product has to be simplified, not dumbed down, but made into an elegant solution that's easy for a mass market or a horizontal market to adopt to. That's really what we talk about with a friction-free product. That's in stage four.
And let's talk about an example there also. You mentioned the smartphones certainly became part of the tornado, that hypergrowth stage. What's one that might not come to mind as easily for us?
Sure. So anything that requires complicated install, one of the beauties of Apple, and it's such an easy one to give as an example, is you know, the instruction card for a new Apple product, particularly a phone, is one small playing card size to get you going. It's not, please spend the weekend installing or deinstalling things to actually get your PC to work.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that smacks of a project is the antithesis of what you want as a friction-free product in Tornado. It should be an easy to buy, easy to sell, easy to deploy, easy to enjoy. And if it's not, then it gets rejected either as a category or you lose and competitors who have a more elegant solution do a much better job of going to market.
So I have a really good counterexample for you. I recently purchased a new laptop, and I won't say the brand offhand so we don't get them or us in any trouble. But overall, really nice laptop, with the exception that it came with this little card. And for some reason, it came with Windows 7 installed with upgrade, you know, to Windows 10 Pro. And the little card said, for optimal experience with Windows 10, you need to reformat the hard drive and change the BIOS.
Right.
Okay, so this now became a half-day project for me if I just want to upgrade to the operating system, right? It should have just come that way already. There was a lot of friction built into that for me.
And that damages brand, reputation, word of mouth. You will have viral word of mouth, but it's the negative kind, not the positive kind. So all those negatives. And by the way, that's a great offer for early market as an MVP 80% whole product. In fact, early adopters would say, I don't mind the challenge of the whole BIOS change. And in fact, when I get done with that over the weekend, I'm going to feel like I'm the master of my own domain. I did this well, and I never had to read the instructions. That felt great.
Yeah, and that's a good example of some of the characteristics of that early market, right? That they're more willing to dive in. If they see that 80% solution that meets their needs, well, shoot, 80% is a lot of value to those early adopters. And they'll take those extra steps to get those benefits from that that early product.
And Chad, that comes back to the point of one of the first things we do with our clients. But you can also get to this if you go to my LinkedIn site and read about some of the blogs around best and worst practices. But wherever you go, whether it's our books or my blog or anything else, what you'll see is the following, which is if you don't know what stage you are actually entering the market in, you might be in for a frustrating or disappointing surprise on your sales forecasts. So with what Chad just mentioned, if you're actually in early market, that's an entirely appropriate offer to do the BIOS work and to install and deinstall and, you know, turn around twice and clap your hands or whatever they want you to do. But in Tornado, they're the pragmatic customers saying, how dare you? I just spent a weekend and there's no satisfaction for me. I'm not getting this Saturday and Sunday back from the time I spent here versus the time I could have spent with my family or at the athletic club or playing tennis or going hiking. How dare you? And the brand is damaged. And so let's keep in mind that you can have a brand new product as a product manager and launch it, and you are not launching into early market. The Toyota people working on the new Camry or the new hybrid Prius that's coming out in 2018, right now they're working on the clay models of it and so forth. It's only 50% done, but if you ask them, where is this going to land when it gets launched? It's not early market. My God, certainly not there. It's going to go right into Main Street. You know, the main marketplace, we call it stage five. And what we'll do is segue to that piece and say from what we'll call the frictionless product in Tornado to get it out there in mass market or pure horizontal play, Main Street changes once again. And now it's whole product plus one. You need a standard whole product, a great hybrid car or a great burrito or a great set of devices around construction equipment. But once you're on Main Street, you also do what we call whole product plus one, which is nice enhancements. Not only those, you still sell the core product, but you sell enhancements that have either, you know, better battery life or deeper memory or greater flavor or whatever it is that change the customer experience in some way and goes back to a segment solution. So a product manager goes from minimum viable product in the early market with that 80% solution to minimum viable whole product to cross the chasm, to a frictionless product in Tornado, to a standard whole product on Main Street, with also, at the same time, not an either or, but a both, a whole product plus one. If your head is spinning at this point as a product manager, I've got some good news for you. That's what a company needs to be thinking about. The reality is if you're a product manager, you typically have a product or a series of products in either one or two of those lifecycle stages. Just make sure you know where you are so you're not behaving and pulling the wrong levers. So I hope that's a useful way to think about the kind of bifurcation of the marketplace.
So a key takeaway here is that to relate this to the category and not think about that a new product is coming out necessarily what we might think of in terms of the traditional product life cycle. At the beginning of that, it's introduced and then it grows. In this target market model, we're thinking about the categories that the product is being launched in to match the category.
Right.
And as you said, if it's a brand new category, the category doesn't exist or the category is just emerging, then we're at that early market stage.
Exactly.
Regardless of how mature our product may or may not be at that point.
Correct. Right. And you may not be ready, and you might say, we're in early market, we're not ready to launch, but you could have competitors where the category, for example, if you're coming out with the newest, best and greatest hybrid automobile for the U.S. market, you might say, we're still in early market, it's still in the lab. No, you're not. You're in Tornado, and you're not going to enjoy Tornado because a couple other players are already out there dominating the marketplace. So please find either something else to do or do a complete, highly disruptive offer on hybrid that comes back to early market but earns its way back later to the main marketplace. And so it's a map. It's a map that tells us where we are and how we move forward and then align what we call our 9-point strategies to really complement that based on the target market model stage that we're in.
And on that automotive example, so just take that a step further, like when Hyundai hit the U.S. market, you know, obviously there's lots of cars already. So we know that we're not at the early market. We're past that. And so we'd be in the Tornado. There's plenty of cars available. Correct me as I go through this with anything that's wrong. But like one thing that Hyundai did to kind of stand out, separate themselves from the crowd, and also to make there be less friction to purchase this rather unknown brand in the U.S., was they provided that 10-year warranty. Right? That was the thing that set them apart. And you go, well, I don't really know the brand well, but it sure looked like all the other offerings that are available to me, and the price is right, and they're providing the 10-year warranty that no one else is. That certainly would decrease my friction as a buyer. So that would put them in that Tornado stage, right?
I think you're close. I think the example is a vivid one and an excellent one for Hyundai. They were late to market. They kind of missed the train, mm-hmm. you know, let's say by 40 years for the consumer market in the U.S. as far as growth, but that's okay. But it's actually past Tornado, where in the U.S. market, it might be in China or in India, the automobile business for consumers might be actually still in bowling alley or early Tornado. But we could argue that for traditional gasoline-powered, you know, cars, that in those cases, it was already middle Main Street by the time Hyundai came in. So it was even more behooving them to come out with an offer that was a pretty outrageous offer that nobody else was going to match. But it gave some customers certainty that these guys are going to take care of me over the 10-year period. The only skeptic might be, never heard of this company. Are they going to be around in 10 years to honor my warranty? Might be a real skeptical question from a customer. But of course, they have been around and they've earned their way into a pretty tough market and still aren't doing great, but have certainly at least built a presence in the U.S. marketplace.
Good. Thanks for clarifying that. I think that's a good discussion to help think about, well, where are we really, right? Because I kind of latched on to the, we're decreasing friction, but I lost track that, well, clearly they are just selling a product like any other car out there too. And that would put us in the Main Street. Now, if we contrast that to, I don't know if you've heard of Elo Motors. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. I think it's E-L-L-O. And they're basically doing a motorcycle car, right? It's two wheels in the front, one in the back, and they're hoping to have MPGs of 80 miles or higher, you know, 80 miles per gallon or more. And this is really a whole new category, right?
Yes.
It's a vehicle that we don't have yet. Environmentally friendly, high fuel economy, and just different in many different ways, right? We don't see these things on the road. So they are reaching the early market now.
Correct, yeah. And what we can hope and pray for them is that they don't get what we'll call, and I'm making this up on the spot, Segway-itis.
Right.
By Segway-itis, we would say a very compelling breakthrough new way to transport people that has crossed the chasm. Segways have. But they never went to Tornado,
right.
And they stay in the segment forever. It's law enforcement at large, you know, gatherings and such in a park. Instead of equestrians, they'll use Segways. Or at the airport, there's an application there that's still bowling alley. Mm-hmm. Or it might be a tourist destination. Again, I don't know why tourists would want to get on a Segway in a place they've never been before, but, you know, that's their choice. But the reality is those are segments. And what that kind of proves is Segways have now segued, no pun intended, to Main Street, but have bypassed the Tornado. Most of us in our lives, if you check in your garage, you might have a bicycle, you might have a motorcycle, you might have a car or a hybrid, but you don't have a Segway parked there.
Right.
And so what we're going to see is it never went horizontal and it went directly what we'll call into a bowling alley forever mutation to Main Street. Doesn't mean bad. It just means that in your case, with the Elo example, the question is going to be, can they forecast now in the early market with this, what was it, a three-wheel vehicle, as to whether they can hit some beachheads, some bowling pins, and then either continue in those segments or actually scale it into a horizontal business. And that's a question of, is the market ready for that, and will it be ready for that in 2 to 5 years?
Very good. Okay. So we've gotten ourselves through Main Street. Does our model stop here?
It does not. Like any good model, it's iterative. There is at the very end what we'll call total assimilation. And then one of two things happen, Chad. One is the arrows go from Main Street back to the left-hand side with a renewal strategy. A renewal strategy is when you do something that's way beyond a plus one innovation that resets the category. So think of this, a Tesla automobile, if we stuck in the automobile examples, still has windshield wipers, still has brakes, still has four tires, et cetera. But that's a renewal back from the traditional internal combustion engine all the way to early market. And, you know, Elon Musk and the team there have done an amazing job. Teslas are a renewal strategy back to early market. They have now been in process of crossing the chasm. There's hundreds of thousands of sold, but it's still an early bowling alley, very geographically specific. Certain major cities have a lot and certain places may not have any. But the example is that's a renewal strategy back. The other likelihood or possibility is that the category basically fades. If you think of things like dot matrix printing, or things that have really moved from Main Street to total assimilation to what we'll call past the zone of no return, that is when the category fades, like we'll see silver halide printing, analog printing versus digital printing of photos, where eventually it moves all the way to the right and sad things happen. I have great admiration for companies like Kodak. They still have some amazing value props in certain specific niches. But getting Kodak may not be the thing you want to have happen, which is having your category eventually move out of the marketplace, displaced by something fundamentally newer that basically rocks your world in a way that that you had 20 years notice and couldn't do anything about it.
Right.
So it's a pretty cruel, it's a pretty cool adoption, a pretty cool, but also pretty cruel adoption world when you think about it.
On that point, and I think Kodak is such a sad example, sad in the sense that they were so incredibly innovative. And as I've talked to some of the insiders there that were in R&D, still have innovations that haven't made it to the marketplace through other companies yet. Incredible things in imaging. And they could have changed their business model over. What should companies be doing to look for that category disruptor, right? That's going to disrupt the category of business that they're in and be an impact to their future success if they don't take some action?
Got it. Yep. Well, at the risk of pushing chasm books, but just the concept itself. So crossing the chasm is about getting from the early market to the main marketplace. Another book we have, and again, you could just read the summaries coming from my LinkedIn page without having to buy the whole book. We have a book called Escape Velocity. And Escape Velocity is exactly what Chad's describing, which is how do you, when you get to Main Street, remain profitable and manage those businesses on Main Street in a way that really respects and honors the legacy products, but also do a departure or disruptive innovation by taking that sweeping arrow back to the left-hand side and doing something new. That's not easy. If you remember back to your four-year-old or five-year-old days when your parents or your uncle would joke around with you at dinner and say, hey, can you rub your tummy and pat your head at the same time? And you'd finally giggle enough and stop and even try doing it. Companies have a hard time patting their tummy and tapping their head as well at the same time. What that really says is to be a mainstream player in a mature market and also go back and disrupt yourself with new offers is one of the most difficult things for any great company to do. And that's why the Fortune 100 changes so quickly, which is most companies don't achieve escape velocity.
Right. And Clayton Christensen, when he talked about disruptive technology like that, disruptive innovation, said the only way to do it is that you set up a different business entity and you isolate it from what you're doing today.
You got it. Exactly. And, you know, Clayton Christensen, who I have a lot of respect for, in fact, he was one of my professors at Harvard Business School many years ago when I first went there for my MBA program. He's written some amazing books, and the Innovator's Dilemma book is one of them. If you haven't read that book, it's not from the Chasm team, but it's fantastic, and we see him as a colleague. The idea really is that you cannot do it as a wholly owned internal team inside your current organization. The antibodies are too tough.
Right.
And that to really renew back, you need a separate building with a separate P&L and a separate general manager. And the irony is most of the time, even that's a challenge and the company ends up being spun off and then maybe purchased back later when it really gets its legs of adolescence. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on with that. And that's really, Chad, where, you know, part of the you and I were talking about kind of quotes around innovation. The one that I center on in most of my talks, whether it's at the Product Management Festival in Zurich that I spoke at the last couple of years, or here in the U.S. in some of the tech ones, it's really the idea about there is absolutely not, it is not true that there is a lack of innovation in the U.S. or worldwide economy. There's lots of innovation. The true lack or the true failure is to get those new innovations to market. And that's actually why innovators and product managers are some of the most important people for building, you know, well put together successful countries and GNPs and thriving markets, is by getting those to market in a way that really works. And that's what we think, we've made some small contributions along those lines in getting not just people to innovate, because that's not the easy part, but it's the easier part. It's how do you commercialize those innovations? That's really what I think a lot of the work that you're doing, Chad, with your team and with your podcast is all about.
And I appreciate sharing that perspective too, that, you know, I often talk about, it's not that we lack ideas. Execution is the key part about making a product real, but it's still all those steps in getting anyone to care about your product. You know, even if you made a valuable product, you have to attract those that would find value in it so they know about it.
Right.
And those are not small, simple things.
Well, and maybe that's a good part to kind of summarize a key point on, which is what we've seen, and we've done a study now of 255 different companies in both tech and non-tech around innovation. And one of our key conclusions, you know, around that is, A, we know innovation is hard, but getting to market with those things are actually, you know, even harder. But the reality specifically is as follows, which is that there's 9 points of failure in going to market. There's not 10, there's not 15, there's not 3, there's 9 of them. And we've actually identified those over the last decade and built that into our process. And so if you're interested in what those 9 are, again, if you go to the LinkedIn page of myself, of Michael Eckhart, you'll see them listed there. Of those 9, some of those are going to be very unsurprising. Mm-hmm. One might be, if you're not clear on who the target customer is and what their problem is, surrender now. That's an obvious one. But another one is, what kind of whole product do you need to actually be delivering? Do you know what stage of life you're in the category adoption lifecycle? And what's the real compelling reason for somebody to want to switch? So those 9 areas are the ones that we view as the scorable, rateable, quantifiable ones that tell us, are we in trouble? Do we have a hot product on hand? Or are we somewhere in the middle with what we're going after?
And I think that would be real valuable for everyday innovators to check out. And I'll put that in the show notes too, a link to those 9 items.
Great.
The, you know, 2 key takeaways from our discussion here for me is, one is that the category is what matters so much. When we're thinking about launching a new product, we need to think about what category we're launching into. You know, are we at the early market? Category doesn't really exist, or it's just starting now. Or, you know, are we further down the line? We need to find that bowling aisle that's emerging, or make our product have less friction, we're in the tornado. Or, like the example of the car, you know, where if it's Hyundai and the other normal combustion cars, we're in the main street, right? And how do we differentiate there and create new enhancements for our products? That's a key takeaway, that the recognizing how the category that you're entering impacts your plans. And then the other point is that we're not just, so many times when we're in product management, we kind of get stuck in this trap of thinking that we should just need to add more features to create more benefits for our customers, not recognizing who those customers actually are and where they are in this life cycle.
Right.
Because different customers will expect there to be different benefits to them.
Well, Chad, once you got us going on this topic, the idea about features, let's bring that one up one more time since you mentioned it, which is in chasm crossing, in really getting that minimum viable whole product together for the pragmatist audience who wants to see a real result and a proven result before they buy. The number one sin we see in great companies, tech and non-tech, around product managers is for them to be in a room saying, we're not hitting our sales forecasts. We know we have to cross this proverbial chasm. What other possible features could we add in here to make this offer, this whole product, even more compelling?
Right.
And in about 80 to 84% of the cases, the answer says that that was the wrong question. And the wrong question is not what do we add in, but actually what do we subtract What do we take out? What do we defeature to actually simplify the product
and
make it really solve the problem and not be the feature creep that later on may be okay on Main Street. You can swear by those plus ones, but in Chasm Crossing, it's about minimizing, not about feature creep or over-featuring the product. And that's a tough one because most of us believe more is better, and that's not the case in 80 to 84% of the cases.
And that's a good metric to have, you know, that 84% number. You know, the early market should be about solving one clear problem and solving it as simply as possible.
Right.
The other thing I would like for you to just emphasize again for us, get your comments on this. So that was one problem in the early market is adding features when they're not needed. The other thing you did tell us that I still see happening too much is, you know, same scenario, we're not making our sales. Let's go find new markets to go after, right? We're not doing well over here, you know, with lawyers. Let's go see if there's another professional group that we can reach out to. And you said, you know, the bowling alley is about that first domino, that first pin. Where do we spend our energy? But there's companies that say, why limit ourselves? Why not go after 10 different markets at the same time? What about that?
Great question. It sounds at its best if you're investing for your retirement to diversify across 10 or 20 different companies, stocks, mutual funds, et cetera. The irony is that the very one place where diversification of your strategies will cause failure about 70 to 78% of the time based on our data is if you do too much broad chasm crossing attempts. So 10 different application areas saying, hey, one of those is going to win. Let's just play the cards right and take a level of spreading the risk. It's actually increasing your risk. And so what we say is the early market is about having those 10 different segments and testing things out with early customers. There's nothing wrong with that. But then at some point, you assemble your D-Day fleet, your D-Day invasion, and you focus on one beach to hit, not 10 of them. The reality is that you know, Amazon, great company today. They'll sell everything from lawn furniture to retirement accounts to diamond studded earrings to you know, cloud-based storage with their Amazon Web Services. What do they start with?
Books.
First 5 years was one of the most mundane categories you can think of,
right?
Books. They nailed it. They got the whole e-commerce platform set up. They found a product that was easy to buy and easy to sell online, and only later went to the other 65,000 products. We've got plenty of examples, whether it's Apple with iPads and iPhones and iPods, focused initially and then horizontal, or whether it's Salesforce, or whether it's even companies and restaurants and business models around CPG, it's go solve somebody's problem first before you try to solve everybody's. And that's really what the genesis of our books and our and our work have been about.
Yeah. An example of that, in a previous episode, we actually talked about a company that did this, which was they were pursuing in the early market 10 different categories, right? More specifically, 10 different sectors and industries. And what they ended up with was 10 products that met the needs of 10 customers that they could never mature to a point where they could really cross the chasm and reach a larger market for them. And they eventually had to just kill off that whole product line concept because there wasn't any way to sustain it. They were distributed too thinly across those customers.
That's right. Well, and you know, to comment on that as we're finishing up the interview, an important point that you brought up, Chad, which is the early market, many of us in product management, as innovation teams, as executives, we all agree that the early market is about educate as a key verb. But it turns out the early market is not about educate the customer or educate the market. It's actually for the market or customers to educate us about which one of those 10 areas that you just described for that particular company, which one or two of those is actually one that scales.
Right.
And which one is really solving a problem that not just a few odd duck early adopters care about, but that the other 85% of the market care about to the right of the chasm. And so we would argue that early market is about launch and learn. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's about learning and education for us as much as it is for the marketplace. And that's a distinction that we sometimes forget about when we're in product management.
Absolutely. It's a great point. And this whole discussion has been so very useful. And again, the graphics and the show notes will help clarify some things. So hope people will go check those out and all the links. And I always ask for that innovation quote at the end, but you already shared the gist of that with us, which is that, you know, we're not lacking innovation. We're really lacking how do we get innovations to market successfully. I appreciate you emphasizing that for us. What's the best way for people to find out about the work you're doing and what do you want to leave people with?
The easiest and best thing is, surprisingly, is not to start by reading one of our books. So that's the typical pitch from a consultant. What I'd recommend is that you go to my LinkedIn page, and you'll see a easy-to-read, three-page blog, and it's called The Seven Deadly Sins, Seven Mistakes to Avoid If You Want to Cross the Chasm. And it's easy reading, and what it does is allow you to really see what the value of both our blogs and our books, and there's even a video or two on my LinkedIn page. You could also go to our website, but the LinkedIn has a much more tidy view of those things. That allows you to see, hey, is this interesting? Do I care? Would I want to get the book? Would I want to download it from Amazon? Plenty of good people don't need to read all our books, but that may give you a catalyst for thinking it through further. And we've had about 30,000 hits on that blog around the seven deadly sins. And it turns out that nobody's doing all seven of these, but there's some major errors going on right now in good companies. And I hope these three pages help, elevate and escalate how to maybe fix some of those and pursue some further strategies to really win in the next, 12 to 18 months in some pretty tough markets, whether it's tech, food and beverage, construction, banking, services, what have you.
And is that the Michael Eckhart, your personal LinkedIn page, or is that the Chasm?
Yes. Okay. That'll be my LinkedIn page, right?
Very good. And I will make that easy to get to, too, in the show notes. And Michael, I so much appreciate the discussion. And even though you didn't emphasize it specifically, I'm going to on your behalf, which is the book really is useful. So the Chasm book lays this out so well. I was one of the early adopters in 1991 that enjoyed reading the first edition so much. And it's only gotten better. So appreciate your group doing that and Jeffrey Moore taking that work on. And thanks for the discussion.
Sure. It's been a pleasure, Chad. Thanks. And good luck to all your audience members as well and their challenging jobs as they look ahead here in the next couple of years.
Thank you for listening. Help other product managers benefit from this podcast by telling them about it. I really appreciate it every time someone does that. And thank you for doing that too. And you'll find all the notes for this discussion with Michael, along with the resources we discussed at theeverydayinnovator.com/079. Please check it out. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.